This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
And good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy, and we've got a great show tonight. George Frazier, author of The Last Wild Places of Kansas, returns to the program, and he brought a room full of experts, and we're going to find out a lot about all sorts of interesting stuff going on in Kansas coming up. But first, a couple quick news items. The Kansas City Star reports that the Kansas City City Council unanimously approved a resolution supporting the Standing Rock Sioux in their resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This resolution happened last week, and again it was unanimous on Thursday. Councilwoman Catherine Shields, sponsor of the resolution, said that in addition to environmental concerns about possible river water contamination, the resolution had a social justice purpose. She said the proposed pipeline project was moved from north of Bismarck, a predominantly white community, to south of Bismarck, where it would affect fragile Native American landscapes and cultural resources. This is really an issue that touches many of us in the community and across the United States. And the thousands of have lined up to march for ahead of the second week of COP22. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Morocco all week outside the 22nd United Nations Climate Change Conference, which the second week has begun, and Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting all week from there. There were thousands taking to the streets demanding climate justice in Morocco. Tune in to KKFI during the week between 8 and 9 a.m. for continued coverage from Democracy Now! Right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And we're going to jump right into our show. I want to welcome back George Frazier. George, thank you so much for coming back to Eco Radio KC.
Mike, thanks so much for having me back. I really appreciate it. And, you know, like Mike said, we have a panel of experts here in all things about wild Kansas, and I kind of want to just jump into it. But, you know, first to sort of introduce our topics, you know, many Kansans consider themselves environmentalists. And we have a lot of people who live in Kansas, in the Kansas City area, who champion environmental causes, and they travel to other states to experience what's left of our American wilderness. But when it comes to actual wild places in Kansas, many people, including lifelong citizens of the state, aren't so familiar with our wild lands. And, you know, access is a big issue. You know, Kansas is a funny place. 98% of our lands are privately owned. And if you consider on top of that, that most Kansans today live in just 5 urban counties and don't have access to wild lands that have been handed down, say, from their parents or grandparents, you know, getting to the bottom of what's really out there can be a challenge. So this is a topic that means a lot to me. And, you know, I wrote this book, The Last Wild Places of Kansas, to address that. And today I brought along some folks who have taken the time and trouble to really get out and travel across Kansas, searching for rare plant and animal species, canoeing our rivers, even participating in some really interesting recent environmental history of the state. And so I want to introduce the panel. First, Lisa Grossman, do you want to say a little about yourself and your interest in this?
Yeah, I'm an artist and live in Lawrence, and half of my work is the Kansas River, mostly aerial views, and the other half is based on the Tallgrass Prairie. So, and I'm on the Board of Friends of the Kaw Secretary this year, and I've learned an awful lot from other experts about the river, but my thing is paddling and exploring the river myself and finding those kinds of river wild places. So.
Very, very nice. And we have Kelly Haggard.
George, yes, my name is Kelly Haggard. I'm a science instructor from Perry-Lecompton High School in Perry, Kansas. And a lot of what I do is try to get kids into native Kansas.
And I have to say about Kelly, he's one of the state's foremost experts on flying squirrels. And so, and we have Shirley Bronlich.
Hi. I've been involved with the Kansas Native Plant Society since about 2000. I'm on their board, and I just very passionate about being outside and encouraging other people to enjoy what we have, because Kansas has more than a lot of other places as far as native habitat. That's about it.
Sounds good. And we also have Joyce Wolf. Joyce, you want to say something about yourself?
Yeah. Sure. I've been mostly involved with the Audubon Society at the local level, Jayhawk Audubon, as the state level, Audubon of Kansas, and I was lucky enough to be elected to the national board and served there for 6 years. The thing that I really like about the state group is that we meet around the state, so we get to see some of these native places and wild places in the state, so it's really an opportunity to get out and see parts of Kansas that we normally wouldn't get to.
Very nice, Joyce. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I found about wild places in Kansas is that these places, besides, you know, maybe having high levels of biodiversity, rare plant or animal species, iconic wild landmarks, these places seem to collect stories. And I wanted to talk to you guys about some of the stories that you have visiting wild places. And I thought maybe I would start with, you know, one of the most iconic wild landmarks we have in the Kansas City area is the Kansas River, and then also the Missouri River, and the confluence of the two places. In fact, the confluence of the Kansas or the Kaw River and the Missouri is part of our founding myth here in Kansas City. And if you think of that story, it usually starts with Lewis and Clark. So, you know, Lewis and Clark, on their way upstream in 1804, they built a redoubt of cottonwood logs to kind of resist an Indian attack that never came. And so they spent several days at the confluence of the Kansas and Missouri River. And so this is about the period of 1804. But the river itself has a much older history, even in the days since European contact. We can go back to 1724, which is so far back in terms of the area's history, when this sort of crazy French nobleman, Bergemont, spent a lot of time in the Kansas River, and he led a very unlikely expedition through the Kaw Valley with the Kansas tribe looking for the Paducah, who we don't really know a lot about that tribe. And so to me, canoeing the Kansas River is a little like hiking on the Santa Fe Trail, but the Santa Fe Trail isn't there anymore. You know, we can go on the Kaw River and experience this kind of rich environmental history that it has. And so, you know, Lisa, what are some of your experiences that, you know, both as an artist and as an expert canoer, you know, on the Kansas River?
I prefer kayaks, but...
details.
Yeah. You know, to me, the Kaw is a place of discovery. There's not a time that I'm out there. Sandbar exploring is my favorite thing to do besides kayaking, camping on the sandbars. There are just so many levels of treasures there, artifacts and ancient bones, and just all these things come together, like people, animals, everything comes to the river. It all ends up there. And when you spend time on the river, you bump into these things, and it's just magical. The first time I launched my kayak on the river, it just opened up 173 miles of playground for me. You know, it's like before that had been inaccessible, it seemed to me. I came from two other river towns, Pittsburgh and Kansas City, and those rivers were huge and really felt inaccessible. But when I moved to Lawrence, there was the Kaw in my backyard, and then I got to explore it. So,
hey, you mentioned sandbars, and indeed, sandbars along, you know, especially the Kansas River and to some extent the Missouri River. When I first started canoeing on the Kaw, you know, the only thing I could really compare it to was beachcombing. You know, looking for sand dollars. But instead of looking for sand dollars, you're looking for woolly mammoth molars.
Exactly.
So, has anyone actually met anyone who's found a mastodon relic or any kind of elephant relic?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
See, to me, that just freaks me out that you can find part of a woolly mammoth. Yeah. And well, I challenge anyone listening to this to go down to the car and look for woolly mammoth molars.
I mean,
or parts
I find blackened, you know, fossilized bison bones all the time, and all of my fellow paddlers do too. And it's fun to take what you find up to the KU Natural History Museum on their fossil day and say, "What's this?" And then it's like, "Wow, you mean a piece of ancient beaver skull or, you know."
Oh, big beavers.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, just things that blow your mind.
Can you tell the listener, do you know what the old ancient beavers
no,
are?
No, I can't.
They're we call them big beavers.
Yeah.
And they're a beaver that was like the size of, basically like a hippopotamus used to swim in the Kansas River. And the blackened bison bones that you're talking about are not necessarily today's bison. Bison.
Antiquus.
So we had bison antiquitus, bison occidentalis. And these were enormous animals. And to me, it's amazing that, there's still the sort of echo of these animals that you can just go and pick up a piece of that history on the Kansas River. Lisa, do you know any more recent stories of, other than, looking for ancient things associated with, you're on the board of Friends of the Kaw, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I know Friends of the Kaw is working to build, boat ramps.
One of the Friends of the Kaw was founded around eliminating dredging on the Kaw, which is kind of destroys the natural way of the river and is harmful in a lot of ways, but also to provide access through boat ramps and education, mainly how to protect our water, keep it clean, and we do cleanups, all kinds of things. But we're all kind of, I won't say all of us, a lot of us are avid paddlers and just really like to get out there and take other people, educational groups on the river to help them understand how it works and learn a little bit about the water quality and, most of the 800,000 people in the most urban areas of Kansas rely on it for drinking water and don't realize that, so...
To me, one of the interesting things about the group, so this is Friends of the Kaw, the website is kansasriver.org, right? So you can go to the website, see a really cool interactive map. But the Friends of the Kaw is part of a larger umbrella group called the Waterkeepers Alliance. Mm-hmm. And the Waterkeepers Alliance has, we call them, that we in Kansas, we have a river keeper, but they have water keepers, all over North America into Central America. And this is, I think it was founded by Robert Kennedy Jr. And that there's an excellent book called Water Keepers about that. But so Friends of the Kaw has a full-time river keeper position, and several people have held it. And I think, it's played a really valuable role in what I personally I think that we're in the midst or at the beginnings of a big river revival in the grasslands. And I think Friends of the Kaw is a big part of that. You see also... these ultra-marathon river races popping up, like the AMR 340. This is a long-distance race that's... oh, my gosh. It sounds so incredibly hard to me. Yeah, don't blow it for me. I want to do it someday. So this race...
You have to do it at least once.
This race starts in Kansas City, and it finishes outside of St. Louis. I think it's St. Charles, 340 miles, and you have 80 hours, right? To complete it.
I think so, yeah.
And,
I did it in 2010 with a dragon boat crew. Wouldn't do it any other way.
Wow, so what was that like?
That wasn't the Kansas River, but we started at
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so part of this, and I think the Kansas City listeners would be interested in this. Part of it is you can't really, if I understand it right, canoe just in the day and finish this. Or did you do any night canoeing?
Oh, yeah. We went straight through 38 hours.
How did you stay awake the whole time? It's like caffeine or...
We were just determined to get it done as quickly as possible.
Right.
So we didn't have to spend two nights out there on the river, which is really demoralizing and difficult. But no, it was another way to experience a river, and I've done races, but... glad to have done them. We got a Guinness World Record, but for the longest dragon boat race.
Right.
But yeah, my favorite way is just being out there in the wilderness of the river alone, you know, it's like...
Tonight would be a great night, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I was out there last night. You mentioned a story I'll just tell. Last night I was on the paddling down from the 8th Street boat ramp in Lawrence and paddled downstream a few miles, starting about 2, and, you know, the light goes really quickly. And on the way back, I got to the ramp just about dark, returning upstream, and I thought, ooh, the moon, it's the super moon, almost.
Right.
And turned around, and there it was coming up over the river. The river was like glass, and there were horned owls and eagles flying over, and just magic, you know. So that's my kind of backyard wilderness, you know. It's right there, but I had the entire experience to myself, and, you know.
Wow. That's really great. So, you know, all this talk of rivers, it makes me kind of want to take a transition. So one of the things about wild places in Kansas, so I think, you know, Kansas doesn't have any true wilderness, so vast, you know, in the federal definition, vast swaths of untrammeled, you know, tops of mountains or whatnot that we have in the American West. And so one of the things that we look for when we're sort of gauging how wild is a place in Kansas is the presence of rare threatened animal species. And I think one of the really interesting sort of wildlife stories in Kansas in recent environmental history is the kind of comeback of one of my sort of totem animals, which is the northern river otter. Mm. So river otters to me are really interesting animals. We believe that river otters certainly were in Kansas at the time of, you know, kind of when the first Europeans showed up. And we believe that they traveled west along all of the riparian niches. And so that means they probably went all the way out to Colorado. But certainly by the turn of the last century, river otter numbers had been decimated. And this is because of the fur trade, for sure. But definitely because of the fall of beaver populations. Because in a place like Kansas, river otters completely depend on the beaver for their kind of nesting holes. You know, they we don't have a lot of rocks and places that they can nest, so they live in beaver holes. So by 1904, the last river otter was trapped in Manhattan on the Kansas River. And so then there's no river otters. And so we fast forward from 1904 to the 1980s. And this story is told, it repeats itself over and over with multiple mammal species. If you think of Kansas and western Missouri at the mid-century, so many mammals had been extirpated. Like, just think of deer today in eastern Kansas. It's like a petting zoo, you know? It's dangerous to drive. But in 1940, we believe that deer were probably extirpated in Kansas. That means there were probably no deer in the state. It's really hard to believe. And so with the story of the river otters, at least, in the late 80s, Lloyd Fox of Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks reintroduced 19 river otters on the South Fork of the Cottonwood River. And so the South Fork of the Cottonwood, it's near Matfield Green in Chase County. It's really one of the most fabulous areas of the state. Kind of if anybody has driven on I-35 to Wichita, when you go by the cattle pens, that's kind of that general area. Now, these river otters, they weren't followed up by subsequent releases. And so this initial stocking probably didn't lead to an otter resurgence. But meanwhile, also in the 1980s, in Missouri, where the river otter had never been completely extirpated, they started reintroducing otters. And there's a lot better river habitat in Missouri. And so quietly, Missouri started to basically become teeming with river otters. And so by the early 2000s, some of those otters started eyeing Kansas and said, you know, we might go check this place out. And so, you know, river otters slowly and quietly started to repopulate some of the riparian niches. And in the early 2000s, you know, there was a lot of questions about where do we have river otters? Will they come back? People were reporting where the river otters were there. And so this is a story that I kind of saw, firsthand. So raise your radio hand if anyone here at the table has seen a river otter in the wild. Kelly, I know you've seen one. So what was your river otter experience?
My river otter experience was actually initiated by a teacher at Lawrence South Junior High. Zach Harwood was a student of mine. I had students camping out at the bar at the Perry City Trails.
The bar?
At the bar.
Like the Bar and Grill bar?
No. At the sandbar.
Oh, I see.
So my kids were groggy and waking up, and as I was stoking the fire, Zach said to me, "Mr. Haggard, what is that?" And I, looking over the river, I thought, well, that's probably a beaver. But then we looked more closely, and this is at the mouth of the Delaware River. And no, it was an otter swimming upstream. And so all credit to Zach Harwood for noticing that.
So how do you know it wasn't a mink? That's what any biologist will say. First of all, when you look for an otter, you think, is it a mink? Because it's a more common animal.
Yes, mink are more common, but they're not nearly as aquatic, nor are they 12 to 15 pounds.
Wow, right.
So this was a big critter.
Very cool. And how about you, Shirley? Have you seen a wild river otter?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be staying at the boat dock just in Lawrence. I guess it's the 8th Street boat ramp.
Right, I think that's what Lisa was talking about, canoeing there just last night.
It was Mother's Day about 3 years ago, and I was standing there texting somebody, and my phone was beeping while I was punching in different keys. And that attracted an otter, and it came right up. And
the otter wanted to use your iPhone? That's crazy.
It just wanted to check out what was that sound.
Okay, wow.
So
that's
it
really
popped
cool.
up out of the water, and it's looking at me, and I'm checking it out. And not sure whether I'm seeing a beaver or an otter, because it was large enough, I knew it wasn't a mink. And I just kept texting because I wanted to report what I was seeing at this point. And it swam under and came back up, and it just kept checking me out, and it kept changing its position and looking up and going back underwater.
Mm-hmm. I think this will be a good time for our first break, and we'll be back with more great stories from the wild of Kansas after this.
The midnight.
The spiritual darkness of doubt. Some call it the dark night of the soul.
There's not a lot going on. You close your eyes, you know, your mind wanders, you don't really feel anything, and you know, the hour is gone, and you open your eyes and zip.
That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
On the next Radioactive Magazine, Radioactive Magazine host Sharon Gibson interviews Judy Sherry of Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and also a compelling interview with Terrence Williams of Bold Poets of Kansas City. That's Grandparents Against Gun Violence and Bold Poets of Kansas City on the next Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday, 6 p.m.
Hold the salt, please, on this current cast. Now that spring has arrived, salt-spreading plow trucks are a fading memory. But Todd Walter of the New York State Water Resources Institute says salt that washed off the roads stays in the soil for months.
It gets down to background levels again, sometimes as late as October, so we're really keeping the system juiced up for a long time.
Rain washes salt out of the soil and into streams, rivers, and lakes, where it harms crustaceans, amphibians such as salamanders and frogs, fish, plants, and more. There's even some concern that road salt might aid the spread of salt-tolerant invasive species. But there's a lot highway departments can do, like adding sand to the mixture to reduce the amount of salt used and still keep us safe. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, yeah. So we were talking about river otters, and one of the reasons I'm mentioning river otters is, you know, to me, you know, a lot of people are interested in birds and they go birding, and birding is great because, you know, birds are accessible and you can see them. But, you know, we can also chart, you know, some of these more unusual animals in Kansas. And, you know, certainly unusual birds fall into that category. But when we talk about mammals and especially otters, I think otters to some people just really signify sort of pure joy in an animal. Because otters, they like to have fun. If you've ever seen, you know, some of the YouTube videos of otters chasing butterflies. and, you know, when I first heard that otters had been extirpated in the state, you know, it just seemed wrong that we couldn't sort of tolerate otters in our state. And, So we've had an interesting experience with the comeback of the otter in Kansas versus Missouri. And I think, you know, they're thriving kind of in both states now. And in Kansas, it's certainly in the eastern part, in the southeastern part of the state especially. Just recently, we've opened up a kind of a fur bear season on otters. And so there's not a lot of tags for those. But it sort of was one. It's an indicator of how successful the comeback has been, and I think there's been discussion in terms of otters coming back in Missouri that, you know, I've heard and read stories and anecdotal accounts that, you know, some people aren't happy that they sort of compete for game fish, and certainly, you know, that might be a valid issue in certain parts of the Ozark streams, but in Kansas. And I've talked to a lot of people about that. I think that we've really tolerated the return of the river otter well. And I think that it hasn't, you know, I think that I talked to someone at Kansas Wildlife and Parks, there's virtually zero complaints. And so I think that it's really a positive story about the Kansas side of the state line. So I want to pivot from river otters to another very unusual mammal in Kansas. And I want to say that it's a rare animal, but it's an unsolved mystery about whether it's rare or not. So little is known about this mammal. I think it's just, its presence in the state is really an enigma. Back in the days when Kansas was a prairie state, a prairie area before, you know, in pre-settlement times, up to about 15% of eastern Kansas was actually covered in forests. And these forests are, you know, at least in northeast Kansas, are the oak forests that connect to the deciduous forests that come from all the way back east. And so one of the animals that lives in deciduous oak forests is the southern flying squirrel. And we know that at statehood, there was a lot of the early sort of scientists that combed over Kansas reported the southern flying squirrel. One of the early chancellors at KU, Francis Snow, he took his students, he was always taking the students out to do cool things. Like they would go fishing on the Wakarusa and then they would realize they're standing on the head of a mastodon. That actually happened. And so they excavated this mastodon basically where K-10 crosses the Wakarusa River. I mean, how cool would that be, I think. But one of the other things he did was he took students out to where the Wakarusa River kind of travels through what today is the Baker Wetlands. And they would go stick their hands in the holes of trees in the wintertime and pull out flying squirrels. So a lot of environmental change has occurred since those days. Okay, so a lot of our original native virgin forests are gone, but not all of them. And a lot of the forest types that we have been converted to sort of scrub woods, which are really not flying squirrel habitat. But flying squirrels persist in the state today. And I'll read you a short piece of my book, from my book. Flying squirrels are forest specialists so far removed from the rhythm of modern American society that few people know they exist. Although the flying squirrel is a state-threatened species in Kansas, even rarer are people who have seen them in the wild. Since 1990, fewer than 25 reports have been filled with the Kansas Biological Survey. That's probably less sightings than we have for mountain lions. And so, Kelly Haggard here, as I mentioned in the intro, if not being the state's foremost expert on flying squirrels, is certainly in the top list. And Kelly did some master's thesis work on the species. Kelly, I would say that you're one of, if a large handful maybe, of people that has actually seen flying squirrel, that have actually seen flying squirrel in the state. So can you tell us a little about your experiences with flying squirrels here in Kansas?
Sure.
First of all, do they really exist?
They do exist, yes.
Okay.
I first was mystified that we had flying squirrels when I was an undergrad at Pittsburgh State University. And I heard about a graduate student, Tom Soloski, who is now a employee of the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks. And he was doing a project on them, and I thought, oh, how cool is that? What a neat animal. And so Emporia State University happened to have a master's program, a part-time master's program for teachers. And I became part of that after I started teaching in the Seaman District in Topeka. And for my thesis project, I decided, well, let's try to go find flying squirrels. That sounds like a neat thing. And I spent a couple years looking. So
I got to stop you there, Kelly. What do you mean by looking?
Did
you walk into the forest and look for flying squirrels at night?
I reviewed the literature, as any good academic might do. And no, I didn't go reaching my hand into holes, which is an important factor that I want to get to later. That it turns out flying squirrels are tiny, they're almost silent, and they're nocturnal. And so when people are active, they're probably not going to come across them. And if they do, they probably wouldn't be aware of it. They communicate in almost inaudible chirps and squeaks. We're all used to our fox squirrels or our gray squirrels around here. It turns out a flying squirrel is 1/5 to 1/8 the size of the normal squirrels we see.
So we're talking like mouse-sized.
In fact, their Latin name, Glaucomus volans, means tiny gray flying mouse.
Hmm. Wow.
Yes, an adult will fit in the palm of your hand. They are cavity nesters, and they're mast feeders, so that they need nuts. I looked for years by using a method from the literature, using a house much like a birdhouse. And the key on the house was the size of the opening, because all other squirrels like checking out holes. And in the course of my thesis, it was intended to measure vegetation. Does the vegetation around a nest box determine if a flying squirrel will use it or not? And I found no difference between the used and unused boxes based on the plant growth. I did find a difference. Of course, this is anecdotal since I didn't specifically measure this. But fox squirrels would come and chew the opening from 1 1/8 inch to about 3 inches across, and fox squirrels would begin to use the box. And all of the boxes that were used by fox squirrels were, after that point, not used by flying squirrels, except in a couple cases with gravid females, that is, pregnant females.
So, Kelly, I want to go back to the experiential aspect of flying squirrels.
Okay.
So, flying squirrels fly. So, have you seen a flying squirrel fly?
Flying squirrels do not fly.
Ah, so that's a subtle point. It's like a dolphin is not a fish.
Good analogy.
That's a horrible analogy.
Our flying mammals, Chiroptera, the bats, hand wing.
Okay.
They actually grab air and flap through the air.
Right.
Flying squirrels, they have a patagium, which is a membrane between their forelimbs and their hind limbs. And it turns out, if you study the physics of it, it has the exact same aspect ratio of a hang glider.
Wow.
So they actually glide through the air. And yes, I've had them glide. I have. In measuring litters of the babies, which look like little pinks, little baby mice, the mothers wouldn't leave. They would crawl all over myself and my brother and my mother, and they would glide to
right.
the neighboring tree and then back to us, flying back and forth. But I did have one of those young that I measured months later. I watched him climb up a Schumard's oak tree in about 80 feet and glide about 110 yards.
Oh, my gosh. That's longer than a football field.
It is.
I do want to tell you how glamorous the business of looking for flying squirrels is, because I have gone with Kelly to check his nest boxes before, and it was a great honor to get to go with you and look for real flying squirrels in the field. And I thought about how fun this would be. And we climbed up on ladders in the woods, and it was really hot that day. And we would open up the flying squirrel boxes, and mice would jump on our faces. We dropped one once, and black widow spiders ran out of them. It was really, really something. So who is, in what's the cartoon that has a flying squirrel?
That would be Rocky and Bullwinkle, Moose and Squirrel.
Ah, so I think that you told me a story about one of the, so there's a flying squirrel that you guys found near Perry Lake, and you want to tell me about that story?
Certainly. So after my thesis, I was successful in finding flying squirrels. I was unsuccessful for several years. I captured over 88 at a location. But after my thesis, I started teaching, and I thought this will be a fun project for my kids. So I decided we'd try to survey Northeast Kansas, and we've set out some boxes. And in 2005, we spotted one. And that class, I happened to have an exchange student from Russia. And in putting our ladder on the tree, it banged the tree, and a flying squirrel came out. She said, "Oh, squirrel!" And I asked her to repeat that 3 or 4 times while I was in stitches. So
the reference is?
To Rocket J. Squirrel.
Right, for anybody that hasn't seen Rocky and Bullwinkle, yeah. Oh, my gosh, that is great. So to me, I'm still a frustrated flying squirrel, explorer. And it's still one of my grails. In my book, I write about flying squirrels, but I never, if you read carefully, I don't write that I find them. I write that I look for them. Kelly.
I was just going to say, on because I'm sure people like me would love to see them. And they are around. I would recommend, if you're interested, consulting your local pest removal service. In 2005, we did get a squirrel into my classroom for a short amount of time, and it came from a homeowner here in the Argentine. And flying squirrels do nest in people's attics, and this unfortunate, she felt herself unfortunate woman, opened her silverware drawer for a flying squirrel to jump in her lap.
Wow.
But she did capture it, and she happened to be a para for my mom teaching in the Shawnee Mission District. And so we brought it for my kids to see, and we checked it out, and we later released it. But I would say, let's look at the ecology of flying squirrels, needing right. this riparian habitat,
right.
a heavy mast, and look at human behavior. You know, you've already mentioned so much of the state is privately owned. How do we manage land? And how many folks can you think of that willingly leave dead trees standing on their place?
Right, right.
And so for a cavity nesting, inconspicuous tiny mammal, the presence of these dead standing trees is essential.
Right.
You know, woodpeckers are going to burrow into that for a food supply or nesting habitat. Flying squirrels actually need multiple locations. They will rotate. They will use a cavity for nesting or defecating or food storage. And using my boxes, they used all three. But imagine a nesting site that becomes infested with fleas.
So you don't want these guys to live in your house and sleep in the bed with you.
Oh, they're so cute, and they've got adorable big eyes, and they're so fun, and they smell like mouse pee. It ruins the whole effect.
I don't trust you. Here, shall sell them short. So the one other thing I'll say about flying squirrels is I talked to some people. I think it's the Wildlife Rescue Group in Linwood. And they occasionally run into flying squirrels. And they told me that the two places that they get the most flying squirrels from are Mission Hills in Kansas City and Leawood. So they're also high-end, you know, they have a high-end taste in real estate. And the last thing that I've heard about flying squirrels is that one way you can look for them is if you find large enough nuts, you can look at how they bore into the side of the nut. Now, I've heard that a white mouse can do a similar thing. But if you have a small hole, a larger squirrel will eviscerate the nut. A flying squirrel will bore out a tiny hole and suck that nut right out through it.
They will make a large elliptical opening. You know, looking at a cute squirrel's face, people fail to realize they have these monstrous incisors, and they're a chewing animal with constantly growing incisors. And so they will chew open, flying squirrels will chew open an elliptical opening on one side of a nut. And I found most of them in a state refuge that was a former pecan grove. And with that opening, they will take their lower incisors and, like a spatula, empty the nut meat out.
Wow.
Whereas the white-footed mouse will eat it from both sides.
Very cool.
Yeah, all right. We're going to go to a break right now. We'll be back with George Frazier, author of The Last Wild Places of Kansas, and he's leading a great discussion on a lot of wild things in Kansas. We'll be back. Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, they say that death comes in threes, and we just lost Leon Russell, and just before that it was Leonard Cohen, and just before that it was All That Is Decent. Join us this Wednesday from 6 to 8 a.m. as we mourn the loss of all three.
Are you looking at a lifetime of debt slavery to pay off your college education? Tune in this week to the Heartland Labor Forum as economist Hossein Bamahi and researcher Allison Fredrickson explore the explosion of student debt and its implications for millennials. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. One of the oldest and largest black churches in America has taken a stand against climate change. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, or AME, has 7,000 congregations and 2.5 million members. Jacqueline DuPont Walker, co-author of the AME's resolution on climate change, says members of their congregations around the world are already affected. For example, by droughts and floods in Zimbabwe, warm temperatures in Alaska, and flooding in Louisiana.
We generally provide ministry in communities that are extremely diverse, but people also have a challenge of not having wealth. So if someone is going to pay attention to the issue of climate change for the communities where we serve, we believe we are called to do this.
So the church is calling on its congregations to integrate climate change into its teachings for adults and children. The resolution also asked them to reduce global warming pollution and to make the issue part of daily conversation.
And we will be actively engaged in trying to impact policy at the local level and at every level of government.
Becoming a voice for communities worldwide that are affected by climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And welcome back to Eco Radio KC here on 90.1 FM KKFI. George Frazier, who's the author of The Last Wild Places of Kansas, is here, and he's leading a wonderful discussion of all sorts of fascinating and little-known aspects of the environmental history of Kansas. And so, George, do carry on.
All right. So we're going to move on from flying squirrels. So, you know, flying squirrels, we don't know how rare they are. They're definitely elusive. But without a doubt, our rarest mammal in the state of Kansas is also one of the rarest mammals on Earth. And that's the black-footed ferret. And so here, I challenge anyone to argue that our recent environmental history is not interesting, because the way that, you know, the black-footed ferret made its circuitous route back to Kansas is, I think, nothing less than fascinating. And it ties in to this aspect of Kansas that 98% of our land is privately owned. Now, the Nature Conservancy just bought a new piece of land called Little Jerusalem, which is like a Niobrara chalk badlands. In Logan County. And Logan County is a fascinating county. It's out in the far western part of the state. And this was the site of what I talk about as really an all-out prairie dog war in the late 2000s. And so the black-footed ferret was thought to be extinct in the 1970s. And then a relic population was discovered in Meteetse, Wyoming. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I may have the agency wrong, but they captured all of the remaining ferrets, and they started a captive breeding program, and this led to then reintroductions in the wild. Now, some people believe that Kansas had the most black-footed ferrets of any, you know, state historically, but they certainly lived here. And in 1954, the last wild black-footed ferret was captured on New Year's Eve by a kid that was driving his car, saw one, grabbed it with his hand, took it home. About 2007, this black-footed ferret recovery team was studying a very interesting ranch in Logan County, and one of the owners was Larry Haverfield. Turned out that this ranch had the biggest extant prairie dog town that was plague-free, and that's important, not because prairie dogs get plague, bubonic plague, like in the Black Death in the Middle Ages. This was the largest plague-free prairie dog town in the entire southern plains. And so I mentioned that 98% of our land is privately owned. So that base, you know, that, and in Kansas, we usually allow landowners to do anything they want, basically, with their private property, you know. That's kind of the way we weigh things, that if your land's privately owned, it's yours to do with what you want. But not entirely, because the landowner, Larry Haverfield and Maxine Blank and the other landowners there, they wanted to have a big prairie dog party on their ranch. And they had a lot of prairie dogs, and it made sense to reintroduce the black-footed ferret. But as soon as, you know, the word got out about this, the Logan County Commission wasn't so happy about it. And so we have an expert on what happened next. But my version, in my memory, because I traveled out there when this was going on, was that the Logan County Commission found an old law that said a township board could go onto private property, poison the prairie dogs there without the landowner's consent, and then send them a bill. And so, you know, that doesn't necessarily jibe with the rest of, you know, the rest of the way we think about private land in Kansas. So, Joyce, what happened after that?
Well, they did, in fact, do just that. It was the Haverfields, the Blanks, and then one other family that collectively...
Gordon Barnhart.
Barnhart's, right. They, I think between the three families, they owned about 27,000 acres. And Larry was somewhat of a maverick, but he was absolutely determined that he wanted to make sure that he had prairie dogs and that they weren't going to be poisoned. Ultimately, it went to the Kansas Supreme Court to allow him to continue to do that. As I mentioned before, one of the great things about being part of the state group is we did meet in Oakley one time, and we had the chance to tour the Haverfield Ranch. And he made his living as a cattle rancher. And I know one of the things that a lot of people think is that you can't mix the two because the cattle will break a leg in the prairie dog.
And that is that prairie dogs would be detrimental to cattle.
Right, exactly. Right. That or they would, they do carry plague, but their population was plague-free. So it was quite a... It was an intense battle for years and years and years. Randy Rathbun from Wichita was their attorney, and it finally came down to the fact that poisoning the prairie dogs with, I think it was Rosol, which is an anticoagulant, it takes about 2 weeks for the prairie dogs to bleed out. In the meantime, they're out and about doing their prairie dog thing and being preyed upon by other animals, one of which are golden eagles, which are protected, and other species that are protected under the Migratory Bird Act. So that was the basis on which they actually were able to keep the prairie dogs and keep them from being poisoned.
Well, I'm glad that sort of had a happy ending, and there are still black-footed ferrets in Logan County. So, you know, we're almost out of time, but Kelly mentioned pecan groves. And so I think that we should lead out with one of the greatest wild places in the Kansas City area, which is the Fort Leavenworth Woods. And so in the early 2000s, in the middle of Fort Leavenworth, some biologists discovered that near Weston Bend across the river was an ancient pecan grove. And the oldest trees in northeast Kansas are there. This pecan grove has a rich environmental history. For one thing, James Audubon went there specifically to hunt the Carolina parakeet, which was our native parrot until we killed them all. And Shirley and I once went on a hike to see these pecan trees, and we didn't make it back there. But can you tell the listeners a little about the Fort Leavenworth woods or just that whole component there and what you know about it?
This is directly opposite where the Weston Bend area is of the Missouri River. And the Fort Leavenworth Reserve, all part of the Army base there, is pristine habitat with potentially 300-year-old pecan trees. I don't know if they've cored any of them to age them, but...
it's a mystery, isn't it? It's a mystery. They may have been planted by Native Americans. They believe there's a grovey aspect to it. I mean, if that's not an incredible sort of, history beyond our written history, and it's in the environment and it's associated with our wild lands, I think it really shows that, you know, the wild lands of Kansas are more than just a place to go on a hike. It's a way to sort of experience our history.
Right. And I love that your book talks about that it's all interwoven, that, well, humans are animals too, but that everything is connected about our earliest history on this land and trying to just discover what was here first. It's a great book.
And I'll echo that. This is Mike Murphy here, and wonderful book by George Frazier, who led this discussion with a group of wonderful people tonight. So, George, thanks again for coming in again and providing us with some great, wonderful content and introducing us to all these wonderful people know about.
Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Going to go over a few calendar events. It seems like a lot going on tomorrow. So in answer to the Indigenous Environmental Network and 350.org's joint call for international solidarity actions on Tuesday, November 15th, supporting the water protectors at Standing Rock, 350 KC will host a rally in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. It'll happen at 4:30, again, that's tomorrow, on the north side of the Bowling Federal Building, which is 601 East 12th Street. And it will be a peaceful rally on the public sidewalk with at least one member of the Lakota Dakota Standing Rock Sioux Tribe speaking. That's tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. at 601 East 12th Street. Also, tomorrow in Lawrence at 6 p.m., or at 7:30 p.m., I'm sorry. It's the premiere in Lawrence of the Seed, the Untold Story, featuring Vandana Shiva. And so you can find out more at seedthemovie.com. Also, there is a Seed Savers class tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m., at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, which is at 4750 Troost here in Kansas City. Class starts at 6 p.m. And then finally, there's a benefits for Stand Up for Standing Rock, Water is Life benefit show this Saturday from 6 to 10 p.m. at Mills Record Company, featuring Solar, as well as Heidi Lynn Gluck, Cody Wyoming, Expo 70, Calvin Arsenia, and more. And that just about does it. We're going to go out, as we do every week, with This Week in Water, brought to you by H2O Radio. And thanks once again to our guests. And do stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
It's a warm summer afternoon in Denver, and people are beating the heat by heading down to the South Platte River. It's the waterway that bisects the city on its journey from the Rocky Mountains to the Great Plains.
Today is the fourth annual South Platte River Fest, and activities range from kayaking the rapids to stand-up paddleboarding to just wading in the river's shallow, sandy bottom to cool off. Nothing says summer fun like being by the water on such a hot day.
Maybe this June, but not the one back in 1965.
Probably few playing in the river today would know that just over 50 years ago, this place was the scene of epic devastation. In 1965, a monster storm turned the normally placid South Platte River into a killing machine.
The metro area received 14 inches of rain in just 3 hours, and that sent a 20-foot wall of water carrying propane tanks, cars, tires, telephone poles, livestock, entire mobile homes, just about anything it could scoop up in its path to carve destruction and chaos.
You know, if it was in the way, it went down. There was just no stopping it.
That's Roger Dudley. He was 18 at the time of the flood and had just graduated from Denver's West High School.
That night, I remember getting up on top of my house. We could hear the announcements as they drove around, making warnings to people that were in the flood zone down below our house. Well, I got up on top of the roof to look around better, and I saw huge sections of Denver going black.
That's because power plants were situated right along the river.
So all three of the Denver metropolitan power plants were inundated with water, and they shut off the power to save the plants. We didn't lose power at our house. Other areas did, and were out for several days.
When the skies finally did clear, 21 people were dead, 1,700 buildings damaged or destroyed, 16 bridges gone, and many streets impassable. Over time, the river slowly retreated to its banks and to being invisible.
That's because before the flood, the South Platte was a cesspool lined by factories and junkyards. It was ignored, neglected, and abused.
It's almost as if in June of 1965, the river said enough is enough and let loose a fury no one could have imagined.
But it didn't only upend structures. It rearranged how Denver city officials thought about the Platte. One politician in particular was very moved by the disaster. Enter Joe Shoemaker.
My dad was in the state senate at the time.
That's Jeff Shoemaker, Joe's son.
The quick history is that he was manager of public works for Denver in the late 50s and early 60s. And like the managers before him and before him, anything you had that you didn't know what to do with in terms of torn up this or dumpy this or lousy this, you just brought it down to the banks of the river and threw it in because the river was already dead and polluted and rotten. So what's one more load of concrete or one more ton of dirt?
In fact, the river was so ignored, many didn't even know or even care that the South Platte ran through the city.
I come from Iowa farm stock, and we were back in northwest Iowa on the farm. My father, as a state senator, got a call from the governor's office saying, as a Denver legislator, you need to get back here. And my dad came out and said, the river's flooded. I got to get on a plane and get home. And my quote to my dad was, what river?
Back in those days, only poor people had houses near the Platte.
Who else who had money would live near a polluted stream of poo? The point is, in 50 years, it is a complete 180-degree change.
That started with his dad. As a state senator, he led several initiatives, the first of which was to find funding to build Chatfield Dam as a bulwark against future floods.
In 1969, my father carried the legislation and created the Urban Drainage and Flood Control District, and its focus is to make sure that the river is safe and is able to carry water as well and as safely as it can.
But even as the South Platte was on its way to being tamed, it was still ecologically dead. It was said you could hear the flow, but not see the water through all the trash. More than just containing the river was needed.
In 1974, he met with the mayor at the time, Bill McNichols, and together, Democrat mayor and Republican senator co-formed the precursor of the Greenway Foundation called the Platte River Development Committee, and 9 volunteers, absolutely no authority of any kind whatsoever. Just a group of volunteers that got some seed money from the city and said, let's go start to save a river.
The very first project they built was Confluence Park, which is where we're standing now. It's the site of the birthplace of the city of Denver, and
42 years ago, the single most polluted place on the river because it was the combination of Cherry Creek and the South Platte.
The Greenway Foundation, now under Jeff's leadership, has helped to construct numerous trails, parks, and ecosystem restoration projects that have vastly improved the health of the South Platte River.
And all you have to do is look around this town and see where the biggest buzz is, and it's all up and down the river. My dad was quoted back in the mid-70s as saying, someday the best place to work, live, and play will be along the South Platte River in Denver, and he was dismissed as a lunatic.
By the looks of all the people playing in the river today, Joe Shoemaker's crazy notion is a dream coming true.
Is the river healthier today? Significantly so. Are there fish in the river? Yes. Are there trout in the river? To a limited basis? Yes. Is it healthier for birds and for mammals? Yes. Is the river clean enough? No. Not close to being clean enough. Can it be better? Yes.
And for that reason, Jeff and the Greenway Foundation are hard at work helping to improve water quality and also by promoting events like the one today that reconnect Denver residents to the river that gave the city its start.
I'm asked all the time when we're done. Jeff, you've been at this 35 years, your foundation for 42, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we're asked that all the time. And as I'm doing now, we laugh. There's no done. There's no done at the zoo. There's no done at the art museum. There's no done at the library. There's no done at the symphony. There's no done. And what was polluted for hundreds of years is just finally getting back to where it can be and it should be. My point is, it takes a lot longer to clean up a river than it does to destroy a river. Wouldn't it be great someday for there not to be a need for a Greenway Foundation? And that day ain't going to happen in my lifetime and probably never will, but we go after it every day, man.
This story is the first in our series on the South Platte River. To see pictures of the Great Flood of 1965, visit our website at h2oradio.org. Reporting from downtown Denver, I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler, and you're listening to H2O Radio.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.